CQ, hello, CQ. This is 2-Emma Talk, Rittle testing. This is 2-Emma Talk, Rittle testing. Hello, CQ. Hello. Hello, Ash. Hello, Ash. Ash, hello.
60 years ago, this voice crackled out over the airwaves from an old ex-army hut in a field just outside Chelmsford. There were few who heard it, some fellow engineers, and a small but growing army of amateur radio experimenters. But it signified the start of British broadcasting.
This is 2-Emma Talk, Rittle testing. Hello, CQ. Hello, CQ. This is 2-Emma Talk, Rittle testing. Calling to you now. Calling, not testing, calling.
In this program, right, we look at the development of sound broadcasting. We also investigate the history of the company that has done so much to create not only the broadcast industry, but also today's worldwide network of telecommunications, Marconi's. It's the story of the man who gave his name to that company and a new word to the English language, wireless. It's the story of Giulio Marconi. Betty Hance, company historian and an expert on the early years of Marconi.
As a young boy, he was never particularly good at school, and his father was always trying to push him along a bit harder. And then he became interested in Hertz. He'd read a little bit about the work that Hertz was doing on electromagnetic waves, and he became interested and did some experiments himself. His father thought he was wasting his time, but like most mothers with their sons, she encouraged him. And gradually, he had got a distance. He could transmit signals of a short distance across the orange groves at the back of the house in Bologna.
These back garden experiments ended when, in 1896, after being turned down by the Italian government, he set sail for England. In that year in London, he took out the world's first patent for a system using wireless telegraphy. In March of that same year, a letter landed on the desk of the then chief of the engineering department of the post office, William Preece. Keith Geddes of the Science Museum takes up the story.
He'd come over from Italy, but fortunately, although his father was Italian, his mother was Irish. She was in fact Annie Jameson of the distillers, and they got quite a number of relatives in London, one of whom was an engineer. He in turn knew an electrical engineer. The electrical engineer, a man called Campbell Swinton, knew the engineer in chief of the post office.
Very much the old boy network.
I'm afraid it was, yes. And he wrote a letter which I think I'd like to read you on March the 30th, 1896. Dear Mr. Preece, I am taking the liberty of sending to you with this note a young Italian of the name of Marconi, who has come over to this country with the idea of getting taken up a new system of telegraphy without wires at which he has been working. It appears to be based upon the use of Hertzian waves and Oliver Lodge's coherer, but from what he tells me, he appears to have got considerably beyond what I believe other people have done in this line. It has occurred to me that you might possibly be kind enough to see him and hear what he has to say, and I also think that what he has done will very likely be of interest to you. Hoping that I am not troubling you too much, believe me, yours very truly, A.A. Campbell Swinton.
So at the age of 22, Marconi began his life's work. At first it was under the patronage of the post office, where in a series of demonstrations he showed and proved that this strange new device not only worked, but could be used to make money.
First thing he did was to set up a permanent station on the Isle of Wight and another one on the mainland, and Lord Kelvin came along and inspected all this installation, and had the idea of sending a telegram to some of his friends, the telegram to be sent by radio across to the mainland and then by the ordinary post office network thereafter. And he knew, and Marconi knew, that communication for money was a post office monopoly. So out of devilment, he said to Marconi, look, I insist on paying you a shilling for sending this across to the mainland. And Marconi took it. Kelvin then had the satisfaction of having originated the world's first commercial radio message. And there's a note upstairs, very agonized note internally to the post office to their solicitor saying, what about this? Is this all right? And the post office decided, I think, that although it was breaking the law, they would be very ill-advised to press it, so they let the matter slide.
It was not long before Marconi hit upon the idea of ships at sea having their own shipboard radio systems. In 1897, he set up the Wireless Telegraph and Signal Company to that very end. In latter years, it was to provide the staff for the service. But it wasn't all that simple. Keith Geddes explains.
It's no good just putting a radio on a ship and saying, right, we've sold you a radio, because a ship's radio is valueless until there are shore stations for it to communicate with. Who's going to pay for the shore stations? In fact, the Marconi Company, partly for business reasons, partly because they could dodge the post office's monopoly this way, they provided a service. You paid them a fee, and this gave you the equipment and the operator and the use of the shore stations. This caused a lot of very bad feeling, because the shore stations were paid for by the Marconi Company, who, reasonably enough, I think, said, well, if we've had the expense of putting these shore stations up, we don't see why we should make them available to our competitors. So, since tuning was pretty primitive in those days, and there were only a limited number of wavelengths available, if you got your shore stations in all the prime locations, it more or less precluded anybody else from putting up shore stations. So that gave you a monopoly of shore stations. This, in turn, tended to give you a monopoly of the whole business. And there was a lot of international feeling. In fact, the Germans called a conference in 1903 mainly on this issue of intercommunication, the fact that Marconis were refusing to collaborate with other systems except in emergency. Finally, the Americans ganged up on Marconi, and about 1910 or thereabouts, said that no ship would be allowed to put into an American port which didn't communicate with anybody else, and this called the Marconi Company's bluff, but it took a long time.
But this was all for the future, for whilst communications with ships at sea was possible by 1900, it was useful only over short distances. Marconi's big challenge was to transmit a signal across the Atlantic. This was to be the greatest test of wireless communication yet, particularly as scientific opinion at the time suggested that wireless waves, like those of light, could only travel in a straight line. They would not follow the curvature of the Earth. It was, they said, impossible. Marconi set out to prove them wrong. One of his assistants, Percy Paget, recalls, in a recording made in 1924, the scene at Signal Hill, overlooking St. John's Harbour in Newfoundland. It is a November day, 1901.
Not a shrub or a tree, only a deserted military hospital, in one room of which Mr. Marconi set up his apparatus. We had brought 2 15-foot balloons and 6 kites for the purpose of elevating the aerial, but the weather was terrible, and for a couple of days we battled with the elements, one of the balloons being carried away by the gale, which snapped the heavy mooring rope like a piece of cotton.
The loss of the more stable balloons meant that Marconi and his team of Paget and Kemp had to fall back on a system of kites from which to hang the aerials. The three of them sat late into the night of December the 12th, 1901, straining to pick up the faint signals they hoped were being transmitted from Poldhu in Cornwall. Paget takes up the story again as the impossible becomes the possible.
We managed to fly a kite up to 400 feet. It flew out over the stormy Atlantic, surging up and down in the gale and tugging at its 600 feet of aerial wire. The icy rain slashed my face as I watched anxiously. The wind howled around the building, where in a small dark room furnished with a table, one chair and some packing cases, Mr. Kemp sat at the simple receiving set, while Mr. Marconi drank a cup of cocoa before taking his turn at listening for the signals which were being transmitted from Poldhu.
But what were Marconi's feelings at this time? Here he looks back to that small shack high on the headland of St. John's Bay and remembers.
I placed the single earphone to my ear and started listening. The receiver on the table before me was very crude. A few coils and condensers and a coherer. No valves, no amplifiers, not even a crystal.
At last they were rewarded. That great moment had come. And in this reconstruction, made just a short while after, the great moment comes.
Listen to this, Kent. Take the headphone. Can you hear anything?
Yes, there it is.
The letter S.
Distinctly, Mr. Marconi. Have it. Come here and listen.
They had succeeded in crossing the Atlantic. Wireless was no longer a short-range device, and from this moment on, the world had become a smaller place.
The result meant much more to me than the mere successful realization of an experiment. It was an epoch in history. I now felt for the first time absolutely certain that the day would come when mankind could be able to send messages without wires, not only across the Atlantic, but between the furthermost ends of the Earth.
1919, an experimental radio station in America, using the call sign KDKA, makes history by broadcasting a program to its few listeners. Meanwhile, at Chelmsford, a number of engineers brought a 15-kilowatt transmitter into action and began testing. This would have passed without comment. Marconi engineers at Chelmsford were always testing new transmitter designs. But rather than read out a list of railway stations as a test signal, they decided for a bit of fun, if only to entertain bored fellow engineers, to press into service members of a local concert party. One of them, now in her 80s, was Winifred Sayer.
I knew one or two fellows who worked at Marconi's, and one of them used to sing rather well. And they took him from his work, and he tried it out with Mr. Ditcham. And at that time, they said, "Well, did they know of a girl who would sing?" And he said, "Well, he thought he did." And so they asked me if I would go, and I went for three evenings, and. It was very sort of rough. It was in a packing shed. I mean, it wasn't anything special. Well, there was a sort of a stand up there with a lot of blue lights flashing, and Mr. Ditcham sat here with a little table, and he gave out the names of stations and that sort of thing. And then they said, "Well, will you sing, you see, and Eddie Cooper to sing?" We each sang separately, and then we sang together. And, I mean, that was the end of it. Well, afterwards, about... Oh, two or three months afterwards, I had a souvenir, and in it there's all these people who had heard, and there was a ship over 1,000 miles out to sea had heard. Well, of course, I was absolutely staggered at that. I mean, I never thought anything about it.
How did you feel? Was there a sense of excitement by being asked to go up and be the first?
No. They gave me 10 shillings a night. And I was there a half an hour. But it was strictly business. I mean, there wasn't any sort of concert or any sort of thing. I mean, you went and you came out.
What did you sing?
There was one or two things. But, if we didn't have any music, we had to think of something that was short and easy. And there was a song called, quite popular at the time, called Absent. And I sang that. And then we sang a duet. I don't think there was anything else, because in between we had to wait, you see, while they sort of did a little bit more talking, and then did a little bit more things, you see. The Daily Mail got Madame Melba to come and sing, and I knew that exactly what she was going to do, so I wrote and asked the manager at Marconi's at the time if I could go and hear her sing. And he wrote back and said, yes, I could, but it was only for me. I couldn't take anyone with me. And I went. Well, of course, her reception there was vastly different to mine. I mean, there was a carpet on the floor and a grand piano and two accompanists and that. And I didn't go in the room. I only just stood at the door. But I didn't go in where she was. Oh, well, she got paid £1,000 by the Daily Mail. And I mean to say, she went in and there was this marvellous carpet. She kicked that up straight away. She didn't want that on the floor. She was the first person, but they had other people afterwards. And there was some gentleman when he came out, they happened to say that I had done it before, and he tapped me on the shoulder and he said, "Oh, young lady," he said, "I think you must have made history."
Despite the interest in these broadcast concerts, the Marconi Company view at the time was that the future lay with the transmission of information, not entertainment. So the station closed down. But the public, at least those few hundred who had listened, wanted more, as Sir Noel Ashbridge explained in a BBC recording made some 20 years after his work in establishing the station.
At last, it was announced that a wireless telephony programme would be permitted once a week, for half an hour. The station chosen was Rittle, with a power of half a kilowatt. So it was that we engineers down there in Essex received instructions to start. We had no experience of broadcasting, and our equipment was primitive, to say the least of it. We had one army hut, but as an amusing example of this kind of thing, although as a matter of fact, our regular concerts did not start until early 1922, I would like you to hear a gramophone record which was once made of Captain Eckersley in action at Rittle.
Hello, CQ. Hello, CQ. This is 2-Emma-Tuck. 2-Emma-Tuck. This is 2-Emma-Tuck calling. Is that all right, Ash? Kirk, is it all right? You sure? What? I'm blasting. Hello, CQ. I'm blasting. Do you want a blast? I blast a whole lot. But, how are you tonight? I'm afraid, there's a bit of rather serious things have happened this evening. We did expect to get some rather famous singer, but, she failed. Singers fail, you know. They do. And we've got tonight a number of gramophone records, as usual. And, hello, what? What you say? What, Kirk? Oh, it's not going out at all. Are you quite sure? Well, it's your fault. For heaven's sake, then connect it up. Well, it isn't. Oh, it is. Hello, CQ. This has all been going on. I'm sorry, there was a big misunderstanding. A little bit of a technical hitch. Yes, you have them too. I know. Aren't they awful? Well, anyway, I think we'll be ready to begin now. And the first thing I've got to introduce is a record entitled. By the way, why are all records entitled? Why aren't they called something? A record entitled, Because God Made Thee Mine. And so, well, our concert ended, and as usual, CQ, yes, the usual song, I know. Dearest, the concert ended, sad wails the heterodyne. You must soon switch off your valves, I must soon switch off mine. Write back and say you heard me, your distance and where and how. Hark for the engines failing, wow, 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 wow. And like that. Well, good night, CQ. God bless you and keep you. I can't. God bless you. Goodbye. Good night.
Happy days for an engineer. But as Captain P.P. Eckersley, leader of the band of pioneers, recalled a few years later, conditions at Chelmsford in those early days were difficult, but they were not without fun.
If you got a wireless set as an amateur which had never done more than go pa 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 pa, and then suddenly you heard a voice or even music. I mean, it was fascinating. And the date? Well, 1919-1920. Well, in this country, of course, you know, we carry red flags in front of the microphone. We carry them in front of the motor car. And the Postmaster General, on whom be everlasting peace, realized that we couldn't have such a thing as this without committed judgment and serious consideration. But somehow or another, there was an idea among the amateurs. Who are amateurs? They're called hams. They're the people who wound coils and drilled ebonite and did all the happy things that you do with valves and wireless sets. And they petitioned the then Postmaster General that they might have a station so that they could have a constant source against which to calibrate their receivers. And the result of this petition was, very naturally, it was turned down. But under the influence of shock tactics, the preparation of another petition, eventually it was decided that there should be a station for these amateurs. I happened to be in the Marconi Company at the time, and we inhabited a place called Rittle, a hut. Long, low hut, full of long, low people. And we had a wireless transmitter, and we were eventually appointed by the Radio Society of Great Britain to do this thing called broadcasting. We had to talk into this thing and give them signals,
very formal, mark you. There was a license that we were given. The license said that the power had to be limited to 1 kilowatt, was it? And that had to include the power that was necessary for illuminating or heating the filaments of the valve. But it took 2 kilowatts to do that already. However, we still owe the Postmaster General a number of kilowatts. But we went ahead, nevertheless, and that's how probably the first regular broadcasting station in Britain ever started. There was one before it. I'm a little jealous about the one that preceded it. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm talking about regular broadcasting, and gee, boy, were we regular. We were half an hour a week. Half an hour a week, every Tuesday. And we just broadcast, that's all. At first of all, it was terribly formal. The man picked up the microphone and said, "Hello, CQ, this is 2 Emma Tockrittle calling. And we will now play you a gramophone record entitled." The curious thing with a gramophone record is always entitled. They're not called anything. And we just put on the gramophone record and then it was switched off. And then we had to wait 3 minutes to listen out to find if we were interfering with legitimate services. Well, we were illegitimate, obviously, in those days. And we listened out and we weren't interfering and we went on. And then one day, I never took part in these programs originally, but one day it seemed to me to be rather fun to pick up the microphone. We went to the local and we had some dinner. And I started to broadcast and we didn't wait 3 minutes. And we went on and we talked and at least I talked and we sang and we played the fool and so on. And I think that was the first broadcasting ever in Britain. Mark you, we weren't simply and only interested in broadcasting this frivolous stuff that you might think that we did. We had serious artists. For instance, we had Melchior. Melchior came to sing. I shall never forget Melchior coming. He brought an extraordinarily pretty accompanist. And with an air of intense originality, every member of the staff took this accompanist by the hand to show her our goat. We had a goat in the field next door, which was earthed. It had a peg in the ground and a chain attached to it, and it circulated around this thing. But in the end, of course, the accompanist had to do her job, and she played the opening bars, and one held the microphone in front of the singer's face at a suitable distance that one judged to be about right. Well, Melchior had just been married, apparently, and he'd left his wife comforted by a crystal set in Denmark. And he believed that the louder he sang, the more likely his new wife, was to hear him. And so when the opening bars were played, he gave a bellow which shut the station. Well, he sucked in his breath which pulled the windows shut, and he gave a bellow that shut the station down. And I remember afterwards he used to wander about the place and say, "What's that bust component there?" "Oh, well, of course, that's part of the Melchior breakdown. That is, yes. I got the thing burst into flame." Well, there was another case, I remember, an amusing incident, in which some woman came to sing, and she was all earnest, perhaps, and she sang Irusky lullabies. I told them not to make too Irusky, because remembering our audience, and she sang. Well, of course, I did a lot of imitations at the time. I pretended that we were receiving programs from Italy, and I did an Italian tenor interrupted by Morse and oscillation and so on. And I did other imitations of basses and oh, heaven knows how many. And this woman sang, and they expected to get a lot of appreciative postcards. Unfortunately, they all turned up and said, "Now, that's the best imitation you've ever done." You know, with Rittle, we didn't have any elaborate studio or any wonderful gadgets and things like that. What we had was, when we wanted to play a gramophone record, we had a perfectly good mechanical gramophone with open doors. And you opened the doors, and you put the needle on, and it scratched, and it played little music. And then you held the microphone in front of the open doors where the sound poured out from. Sorry about the preposition at the end of the sentence, but that's how it was. And if you wanted it louder, you just moved the microphone nearer. And if you wanted it softer, you moved the microphone further away. We were able to keep one of the smoothest volumes control that has ever been invented. Of course, today, I mean, there are sliding resistor wires and wonderful faders and this and that, but pioneers are always no best.
That's how British broadcasting began. Now the race was on. Marconi, together with other British wireless manufacturers, was given the go-ahead to start the British Broadcasting Company. Its only revenue would come from a license paid for each receiver sold. It was to have a London-based transmitter and a studio. Its call sign, 2LO. Broadcasting first from Marconi's head office and then from Savoy Hill, 2LO became the vanguard of a chain of local radio stations covering the United Kingdom. It soon became clear, however, that broadcasting was too important to remain the domain of the private sector. So in 1924, 2LO became a monopoly under a royal charter. Thus was born the British Broadcasting Corporation, who, under its first chairman, John Reith, was to formulate the pattern of radio broadcasting for the next 50 years. As the 20s gave way to the depression years of the 30s, and crystal sets and headphones gave way to valves and loudspeakers, these were the sounds of an age, coming into the homes of the people for the first time.
Good afternoon. Well, I'd like to be able to bring this bunch of records to you. And then I'd see from the look on your face whether each one pleased you or bored you. Songs, for instance, that we've heard so often, sung by our friends or by professional artists or played by bands or broadcast, do they still come to your mind with a fragrance of memory?
This is 2LO calling. The Reverend John Mayles, director of Whitechapel, is going to give you a short address.
I have just come from my church in Whitechapel, a great church situated in the midst of all the noise and the turmoil and the dust and the slums and all that Whitechapel connotes. And it is my privilege, by the aid of the wizardry of Mr. Marconi in this wonderful house, to speak, as I understand, to many thousands of people.
Here is the last news bulletin for today. The following items of news indicate the general situation in the country. Copyright in these items is reserved outside the British Isles. At the High Mass in Westminster Cathedral today, His Eminence Cardinal Bourne made the following declaration. The time through which we are now passing is of exceptional character, and the present strike is of a nature quite unlike the many others which have preceded it. It is necessary that the Catholics should have clearly before their minds the moral principles which are involved. There is no moral justification for a general strike of this character.
Lewis and swings the punch at him. Lewis gets away from it and shoots. Short right to left jab to Tommy's face. Tommy goes back and hammers him about the body. Far hammered, Lewis about the body then. They've broken away and they're fighting him out there in the center of the ring. It's a real good round. Far jumping into Lewis again. Long left to the side of Lewis's head. Another left to Lewis's head, and he swings that right over to Lewis's head. He's driving Lewis back against the rope. Far's driving Lewis back against the rope. And
one of the marvels of modern science, I am enabled this Christmas Day to speak to all my peoples throughout the empire.
About 10 o'clock this morning, an Italian note was received in Geneva saying that, in view of Abyssinia's mobilization, the Italian government had been compelled to take all measures in East Africa for self-defense, and these measures might involve the occupation of certain strategic points. Only a few minutes later, an Abyssinian telegram arrived in Geneva saying that Italian planes were at that moment bombing Adowa and Adigrat, about 50 miles east of Adowa, and that a battle was in progress in the province of Agame, adjoining Eritrea.
This is London. Following bulletin was issued at 9:25. The king's life is moving peacefully towards its close.
This is London. It is with great sorrow that we make the following announcement. His Majesty the King passed peacefully away at a few minutes before 12.
Events of major importance happened in Europe today. This morning, German troops made a formal entry into the demilitarized zone on the left bank of the Rhine.
This is the BBC television station at Alexandra Palace. At 3 o'clock this afternoon, the television service was opened by the Postmaster General using the Baird system. The opening program will now be repeated on the Marconi EMI system.
This is Windsor Castle, His Royal Highness Prince Edward.
At long last, I am able to say a few words of my own. I discharged my last duty as king and emperor. And now that I have been succeeded by my brother, the Duke of York, my first words must be to declare my allegiance to him. This I do with all my heart.
Wherefore, all you who are come this day to do your homage and service, are you willing to do the same?
Everybody saying shush, trying to quieten the crowd so that Mr. Chamberlain can make a speech. I'm afraid you won't be able to catch his speech very well, but if he does speak and I can catch what he says, I'll try and convey something to you of what he said. Mr. Chamberlain said that he believes it is peace for our time as he looks round on the crowd of us standing here below.
This is the national program from London. The first news, copyright preserved. And these are today's main events. Germany has invaded Poland and has bombed many towns. General mobilization has been ordered in Britain and France. Parliament was summoned for 6 o'clock this evening.
The only problem for the fledgling BBC was that the public had developed a taste for a private or more commercial form of broadcasting. To meet this need, the early 1930s saw the formation of the International Broadcasting Company. Simply by taking over unused airtime on already established continental radio stations, the IBC were able to provide this new form of commercial broadcasting for their growing army of devoted listeners.
The voices of the Bells of Normandy introducing another broadcast from Radio Normandy Calling, the great touring stage show coming to you tonight from the stage of the Alhambra Theatre, Bradford.
This is Radio Luxembourg on our new frequency, 208 meters on the medium wave band.
This program is sent to you by Huntley and Palmer, makers of biscuits and cakes. It is especially designed so that each week our programs will present to you the changes that have taken place in music during the past 100 years. We were starting our series with a selection of music composed about the same time as Huntley and Palmer started their factory 100 years ago. Now bear in mind that Huntley and Palmer's stand for quality. And like the music of the famous composers of their time, they are still supreme. We'll commence our concert with our signature tune, Music Through the Ages.
Well, yes, you know what that means. That means your old friend Millennium Bill's on parade. That's a program with lots of fun and some stirring martial music. It comes to you at 11:15 on Sunday morning. Let's listen to Bill for a minute.
No, it's like that. You don't like Maggie's plum duff.
No.
And you don't like her stew.
No.
Do you like Maggie?
Yes, enough.
Yeah. Do you like me?
Not much.
Limelight on Rhythm. That follows immediately on Millennium Bill. And it's used to make you swing fans stick up your ears. A jam session swung for you by John Collins' Rhythm 6 with the husky, fascinating hauteur of Dinah Miller, the personality girl.
You're very sure now. I may not be the best in town, but I'll be the best of the best around. How I do, Dave. Keep up to the beat, Dave.
And here are the 5 Shelley brothers, and they really are brothers. They're all tall and dark, and they look very much alike, and in this scene, they're wearing evening dress. They're an incredibly versatile bunch of people. During the show, they've been dancing and playing instruments and doing sketches, and now you're going to hear them singing. two of them, by the way, have got a violin and a guitar.
I like that, didn't you? Thank you, Joan. Thank you, Wendy. Thank you, Kay. Now, I'm going to sing the number that I've been asked for more than any other since I've been singing on the air. And I think it's my own favorite, too. Little man, you've had a busy day.
Little man, you're crying. I know why you're blue. Someone took your kitty car away. Better go to sleep now, little man. You've had a busy day.
It was not to last, however, for with Europe moving closer to open war, that wireless, taking pride of place on the nation's sideboards, took on a new meaning.
I am speaking to you from the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit uplands. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty. So bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its commonwealths last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was their finest hour.
Germany calling, Germany calling, Germany calling. Here are the Reichsfänger Armboys, station Bremen and station VXB on the fat 1 meter band.
The news, and this is Frank Phillips reading it. Our submarines and aircraft in the Mediterranean have had big successes against Italian shipping. A 23,000-ton liner and a 10,000-ton cruiser have been torpedoed. Two other supply ships have been sunk and an enemy destroyer wrecked. 10 Italian aircraft have been shot down in the Mediterranean for the loss of 2 of ours.
Here is the news, and this is Frederick Allen reading it. Blenheim blew up an escort vessel and set a supply ship on fire off the Dutch coast in daylight today. Last night, our aircraft bombed an important factory hidden in the woods of the Rhineland, while coastal command machines attacked targets off the Norwegian coast.
Here's the news. This is Wilfred Pickles reading it. This morning's news of Japan's aggression is of successful countermeasures against the invasion of Malaya. There have also been reports of enemy attacks on Thailand and Hong Kong. At Shanghai, the Japanese have taken over the international waterfront and sunk the British gunboat Petrel.
Got Sir Talbot here, and we're recording up forward in the desert, and you must forgive me if I'm shouting, because I'm shouting against the voices of British guns. We're up here with some of the batteries, just behind some of the very, very heavy guns, and there's a terrific barrage going on. Standing here in the moonlight, it's the most amazing panorama. For miles from north to south in a great semicircle, there's a whole series of flashes. It's an almost unbroken barrage being pumped into the enemy.
Whilst the wartime BBC provided the necessary news coverage to keep a nation informed, it also took on another function, that of raising the spirits of a nation at war.
Hi, gang. Welcome to the High Gang Show, coming to you from the heart of London, starring B.B. Daniels, Vic Oliver, and Ben Lyon. That's me, folks, with Jay Rove and his officer, Sam Brown, the Green Sisters, and our guest star, whose name we're keeping a secret till later on in the program.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bandwagon brazenly presents Chestnut Corner. All the things we come out with. My wife's a decided blonde.
I know, I was with her when she decided.
Excuse me, sir, but can you spare me a shilling for a cup of coffee?
Shilling, that's a lot for a cup of coffee, isn't it?
Listen, are you trying to tell me how to run my business?
How did you lose your hair?
Worried.
What did you worry about?
Losing my hair.
How are you getting on in your new house?
Oh, fine. I furnished one room by collecting coupons out of soap packets.
That's a grand idea. Why not furnish all the other rooms in the same way?
I can't.
Why not?
They're full of soap.
No,
I've come to change my name.
That'll be an expensive business. What is your name?
Harry Smells.
Ooh, I'm not surprised. What do you want to change it to?
Charlie Smells.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, concludes Chestnut Corner for this evening. Later on, we hope to bring you some even better old jokes. Meanwhile, carry on, Bandwagon.
Shipmates ashore, men of the Merchant Navy from their well-known club near Piccadilly Circus send out their own program over the seven seas. And here to begin it is their cheerful hostess and yours too, Doris Hare.
Hello, shipmates everywhere. Well, come right into your own club for the next half hour and share the gossip and glamour with those shore-leave officers and men of the Merchant.
Dear boys, I've been working in the West End all this week. And using the tubes and buses a lot, I realized how well some of the girls are doing your job while you're away. Good night, boys. Sincerely yours, Vera Lynn.
We'll meet again. Don't know when. Don't know when.
This is London Calling. Here is a news flash. The German radio has just announced that Hitler is dead.
Now we're breaking into our programs with some splendid news from Moscow. Berlin has fallen.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is the news. During the first few moments of this bulletin, the war in Europe is coming to its official end. 1 minute past midnight is the time fixed for the cessation of hostilities.
Prime Minister, the Right Honourable Winston Churchill.
The ceasefire began yesterday to be sounded along all the fronts. The German war is therefore at an end. We may allow ourselves a brief period of rejoicing. Today is Victory in Europe Day.
I'll show them how to celebrate V-Day. I'll organise the celebrations. Now, what should we have first?
A large brandy, sir.
Oh, dear. It's old Beer Gint. Are you still celebrating, Colonel?
I've celebrated every victory since Mafeking, sir.
By the look of your face, you must have started with William the Pub Crawler.
There's only one thing I deeply regret, sir.
What's that? That you haven't got a reserve tank?
No, sir. That on this glorious occasion, they should close any of the public houses any of the time.
I agree.
But
you can close all the pubs all of the time, gentlemen, please.
Can I do you now, sir?
Now, listen up. Tell me, why are you standing on one leg?
Well, sir...
Now, don't tell me. So it was you I saw posing as Eros in Piccadilly on Tuesday night.
Oh, sir, I did enjoy myself.
Really?
Every time I waved my flag, I found myself on top of a taxi with a soldier.
Well, you were lucky to get one. I came home by underground. I slipped down a manhole and caught the last drain.
I brought this for you, sir.
Oh, isn't that nice? What is it, a rubble wristhole?
It's me V-Day offering, sir. I call it peace pudding.
I suppose when you stick your fork in it, it sounds the last all clear.
Oh, sir. Well, TTFN.
Hip, hip, hooray!
What's that, sir?
Three cheers for Winnie.
With the war over, the infant television service resumed, as did Radio Luxembourg, last survivor of the 10-station pre-war IBC continental network. Broadcasting expanded. The national and regional services of the BBC became the home, light, and the newborn third programme. New technical developments became commonplace. For example, the introduction of the very high frequency, or VHF, radio service, which brought with it the new dimension in sound quality. The end of one-channel viewing came with the start of commercial television, but still no independent radio. That is until...
You're tuned to Radio Caroline on 199, your all-day music station.
The date, Easter Monday, 1964. The location, just a few miles off the Essex coast. And a new sound is born.
This is Simon D. talking to you on behalf of all of us on Radio Caroline, here 4.5 miles away from Felixstowe. Now, what can I tell you about the station? Well, our technical equipment, I suppose. Firstly, the transmitters are made by Continental Electronics in the States.
Within a short time, Radio Caroline was joined by 16 sister ships and old wartime Essex forts, all broadcasting a new sound of radio to a public bored with a form of programming that had been almost unchanged for 50 years. New station call signs with new radio personalities were born overnight.
Radio Atlanta, on our very first day, our Shamper's Day, bringing you brighter broadcasting and the finest sounds around.
Within the next few minutes, some lucky Radio Caroline listener could win as much as 1,560 quid.
Now the summer fun time here on the good ship Radio Atlanta stands at 28 minutes after 7 p.m.
Bruce Chanel, and he said, "Hey, baby," and "Hey, baby," you're tuned to Radio Such on 197 meters. The only station that doesn't pretend to swing and doesn't pretend to be with it, but we really are with it.
You're in Jim's Radio Invista, broadcasting on 306 meters on the medium wave. Radio Invista, your good music station, brings you music 13 hours a day, 7 days a week, from 5 a.m. until 6 p.m.
You're tuned to KING, transmitting on 236 meters on the medium wave, and the time, 33 minutes past 1 p.m. You're listening to Lunchbox, introduced by myself, Roger Gomez. And now it's time for myself, Roger Gomez, to tell you about the KING Lucky Carl Sticker Number and such like competition.
I'd like to remind you, now that you're listening to Radio S, the time is 20 minutes before the hour of 2 o'clock. And at 2 o'clock, we have the news for you, and that will be read by David Sinclair. The news is every 2 hours on the hour.
This is wonderful Radio London, where your hearing things, where your caring things.
The government was not amused. For most of the stations, the end came in 1967 with the passing of the Offshore Marine Offences Act.
Some mention has been made of the fact that mine was the first voice to be heard on Radio London. It will also be the last in regrettably few minutes from now. Big L time is 3 o'clock and Radio London is now closing down.
Thank you.
wonderful Big L.
But the pirates changed the face of popular broadcasting forever. Support for a form of land-based commercial independent broadcasting service became demand. As an answer, the old BBC light programme gave way to an all-swinging Radio 1, manned by many of the old shipborne broadcasters. But it was not enough. The public wanted more. They wanted local radio. Within a year, they got it, in the form of a chain of local BBC radio stations. It wasn't much, but it was a start. By 1972, the pressures for local independent radio were such that an Act of Parliament was passed changing the structure of the Independent Television Authority, giving it responsibility for sound broadcasting, and changing its name to the Independent Broadcasting Authority. The Act paved the way for the start of independent local radio, and in late 1973, the all-news station, LBC, in London, was the vanguard of the many that were to follow.
This is London Broadcasting, the news and information voice of independent radio. Welcome to LBC. It's 6 o'clock, October the 8th. My name's David Jessel. This is The Morning Show, and here's the news.
Isn't it good to know? Capital Radio. You can turn on a friend, you can turn on the show, you can turn on the world with Capital Radio. Such a good way to make your day. Capital Castro.
It's a beautiful day, yeah, on 194.
A dream is about to come true, because this, for the very first time, is Radio 4.
Hello there, this is Steve Hamilton on Radio 4, bringing you the Daybreak Show, right through till 9.30. We're sitting at the top of the dial.
Just received an invitation, RSVP, a sentimental journey to Essex with me. I'm inclined to have a mind of taking a trip to Essex. Why don't we take a train or plane or hurry on down? You can please, you ease that way, come as you are. It's somewhere special, we're gonna take it now. The good fortune to be taking the A train to Essex with me. Maybe you'll stay this way permanently. It's somewhere special that we found. Stay around.
Interestingly enough, Marconi's had a part in the formation of ILR, Independent Local Radio. They had the task of finding the locations for the new and future transmitters for the network, as Doug Holden of Marconi's explains.
Well, the requirements on the VHF FM side was to produce a frequency plan
has allowed for up to about 90 local radio stations to be introduced into the band. Already heavily congested with the BBC nationwide programmes and also their local radio network themselves. So we had to provide suitable frequencies for the IBA for these stations.
How did you set about the task?
Well, it was an awe-inspiring task, to say the least. And obviously, we're going to have to use the technology that was available, and we relied very heavily on the computer. The computer did most of our calculations for us, provide signal levels and protected levels of signal strength. And by using the numbers turned out by the computer manually, we were able to produce a frequency plan.
One of these new transmitter sites was to be at Chelmsford, with the start in late 1981 of Essex Radio. The site was located not a stone's throw from that old ex-army hut and the mast of 2MT. Local independent broadcasting had come home, home to where it all began 60 years ago, Chelmsford.
I have striven to give the world improved and cheaper means of communication by electrical transmissions through space.
You've been listening to 60 Years of Radio. The programme was produced by David Gilby and Dennis Rookard. The programme's presenter was Steve Wood.